This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Armed separatists started shooting and the military fired back, killing at least 10 of the attackers.
That's reporter Moki Edwin Kenzeka quoting a Cameroon military spokesman on the ambush attempt against the defense minister's convoy. Details next. Also, Eritrea's president will visit Ethiopia's capital tomorrow in the latest remarkable step towards building bilateral ties after 20 years of conflict and acrimony. And the UN Security Council has approved an arms embargo on South Sudan as agreements by its warring parties have failed to stop the killings and atrocities. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, armed separatists groups fighting for the creation of an English-speaking state in Cameroon have attacked Cameroon's defense minister and his convoy. At least 10 people were killed in the attack in the crisis-prone English-speaking southwest region where the minister was visiting to encourage his military fighting the separatists. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Military spokesperson Colonel Dide Bajek says more than 100 armed separatists mounted several roadblocks on the road linking the southwestern regional town of Kumba and the locality of Monge to stop Defense Minister Joseph Beti Asomo, who was leading a high-profile military delegation dispatched by President Paul Biya to encourage the country's soldiers fighting armed separatists. Bajek says as they removed the roadblocks, armed separatists who were hiding in nearby bushes started shooting and the military fired back, killing at least 10 of the attackers.
La confrontation a commencé, s'il vous plaît, sous des feux bien nourris.
He says the terrorists, who were heavily armed with war weapons, locally made guns, cutlasses and poisoned spears, started shooting ceaselessly towards the military convoy and the minister's car for about 30 minutes. He says the military fired back and hundreds of the attackers escaped to the bushes where they are still being hunted by the military. Several members of the minister's delegation were wounded. Hundreds of villagers and travelers along the road fled to the bushes. Beti Asomo ordered the military to make sure all of the attackers are either arrested or neutralized. He also congratulated the military for what he called successes in the fight against armed separatists since President Biya declared war against them in November 2017, describing the separatists as terrorists.
Les militaires que nous avons rencontrés ont le moral. Ils sont habités.
He says he found a very determined military, ready to fight until peace returns in the English-speaking North, West and South West regions. The armed separatists used social media to warn Cameroon's defense minister against visiting any part of the English-speaking northwest or southwest regions, which they claim as the new state of Ambazonia. Tensions in Cameroon began in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers in the northwest and southwest regions protested, seeking reforms and greater autonomy and expressing frustration with the dominance of the French language and the marginalization of Cameroon's Anglophone population. The crisis intensified when Ayouk Tabe, the self-declared president of the English-speaking Republic of Ambazonia, was arrested alongside 48 others in Nigeria and extradited to Cameroon. More than 160,000 people have been internally displaced and tens of thousands have fled to neighboring Nigeria, according to the United Nations. The government of Cameroon says more than 200 government troops and civilians were killed. International NGO and rights groups have decried the harsh government crackdown and indiscriminate arrests of suspects. Moki Edwin Kenzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Eritrea's president will visit Ethiopia's capital tomorrow in the latest remarkable step towards building bilateral ties after 20 years of conflict and acrimony. President Isaias Afwerki's three-day trip reciprocates a visit to Eritrea last week by Ethiopia's reformist new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed. On the agenda is a visit to an industrial park, underscoring hopes for joint economic development. Just over a month ago, tensions remained high between the two countries, decades after a bloody border war. Now they say their state of war is over, drawing international praise. They have restored severed phone links. Eritrea is reopening its embassy in Addis Ababa on Sunday after 20 years. Flights between the two countries are scheduled to resume Wednesday. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has undertaken other reforms in Africa's second post-populist country that have thrilled many people but angered others. Aid agencies say more than 800,000 people displaced by violence in southern Ethiopia are facing a humanitarian crisis as the rainy season sets in with inadequate shelter to protect them from cold, wet weather. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Hundreds of thousands of people were forced to flee their homes last month when intercommunal clashes broke out in southern Ethiopia's Gedeo and West Guji zones. The International Organization for Migration says people have walked for days to escape the fighting with nothing but the clothes on their back. It says many have been forced to sleep in the open along the way. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says many of the displaced are staying with relatives in local communities or in rented accommodations. Others are sheltering in schools, government buildings, and disused factories.
Thousands of people are crammed into overcrowded collective centers, unfit for human habitation. Others sleep outside on dirt floors with nothing more than a tarpaulin to shield them from the cold and rain. Open fire cooking in overly congested buildings, poor sanitation, and cold weather are all contributing to a worsening environment from both health and protection perspectives.
Aid agencies report the displaced do not have enough food, clean water, shelter, and other basic necessities. They warn people will be at risk of malnutrition and disease outbreaks if humanitarian assistance is not scaled up. Millman says the IOM has distributed 1,000 blankets in the past week and is in the process of building 40 communal shelters and digging 150 latrines. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it, together with the Ethiopia Red Cross, will provide relief to 100,000 people. The agencies say they also will provide medicine and health supplies to local clinics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Security Council has approved an arms embargo on South Sudan as agreements by its warring parties have failed to stop the killing and atrocities. The resolution was sponsored by the US, which backed the country's independence, but says it has given up on President Salva Kiir. That sentiment wasn't helped by Parliament's vote yesterday to give Kiir 3 more years in power, even as the government and rebels have been trying to finalize a power-sharing deal as part of a peace effort. The resolution expresses deep concern that the hostilities have not ended and imposes sanctions against the current deputy defense chief and the former army chief. The UN Human Rights Office says at least 232 civilians were killed and 120 women and girls raped in scorched earth attacks by government forces in Unity states in April and May of this year. Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for Sunday's terrorist attack on a National Guard patrol in northwestern Tunisia. Experts say the attack has cast a heavy shadow over the official approach for dealing with terrorism. The assault occurred at a time when the security establishment was in disarray. This following the dismissal of Lofti Brahim as Interior Minister. William Lawrence is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the renewed threat of terrorism in Tunisia.
Well, this is a long-standing problem dating back to the early 1990s in Algeria and the unresolved conflict that has morphed in the evolution of the various terrorist organizations. Certainly the AQIM-affiliated and the ISIS-affiliated groups in western Tunisia in the beginning had a lot of Algerian members and support from Algeria. And so I see a lot of continuity, you know, rather than newness in terms of the threats from the eastern Algerian, western Tunisian region. AQIM obviously has Mali as its main locus of operations because the Algerians have been very successful in pushing AQIM out of Algeria. And, of course, the countries in the environments are the ones that have picked up some of the fighters and activity that got pushed out of the Algerian space.
The threat is coming from the mountain area across the Tunisian-Algerian border. Is that out of Tunisian government control?
Yes and no. Certainly, these groups have not been able to control even a small rural town. So just like the ISIS fighters who came from Libya and tried to take Ben Gerdan, the government has been successful in holding all populated areas. That said, these groups have been able to operate with some impunity outside of the populated areas. There have been attacks on police forces. There have been local kidnappings of Tunisians and other operations that seem to go relatively unimpeded. And this is in part because of things that happened after 2011. You know, after the revolution, security operations were scaled back and changed in significant ways on human rights grounds and other grounds, but then left the border less protected. And Tunisia hasn't fully replaced what was lost in 2011 in terms of its border operations. They're working on it, but they haven't quite succeeded yet. Some Tunisians describe this as a problem of political will. I see it more as just a problem of capacity.
Tunisia managed in the past to counter ISIS threat, and now it is facing a new threat. Would it overcome this Al-Qaeda threat?
I think it will. I think the spike in terrorism was 2015 when you had three devastating attacks in Tunisia, and there hasn't been much since. Even the latest attack isn't as bad as the third attack in Tunis on security forces in 2015. So the overall track record of Tunisia has been successful in terms of reducing the terrorist threats. So again, I don't see this as a new threat. I see this as a continuing threat. The numbers are not large of these terrorists, but even a small number of terrorists can cause terrible havoc. This is the point of terrorism. And we're in one of those moments where the terrorists have shown the efficacy of their tactics. And of course, it's up to the Tunisian government and the other governments supporting Tunisia and the Tunisian population to help address this problem collectively.
Talking about international help, do you think the United States could help with drones to attack these remote areas of Al-Qaeda?
Yes, I think the use of drones has been somewhat problematic or viewed problematically by populations who associate drones with drone attacks and these kinds of things. But the drones being used in the Sahel and North African region, from my understanding, have by and large been used purely for surveillance reasons, and surveillance drones are useful whether they're Tunisia-controlled or American-controlled or Algerian-controlled. It's just part of a mix of surveillance, including human intelligence on the ground and local cooperation of local populations, all the different kinds of sources you need to do to identify where the bad guys are and where to go after them.
William Lawrence is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. He was speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the renewed threat of terrorism in Tunisia. 19 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Soccer fans around the world will be watching Saturday as England plays Belgium for third place in the World Cup, and on Sunday when France battles Croatia for the title. But In Uganda, police and fans are looking at security venues. The memory of the 2010 attack that killed scores of fans watching the final match remains strong. Police have asked Ugandans to be vigilant and report any threats. Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Football fanatics around the world are eagerly awaiting Sunday's World Cup final between France and Croatia. But in Uganda, the country is marking 8 years since the July 2010 twin bombings in Kampala, killing at least 76 people gathered to watch the World Cup final. Hundreds were injured. Bridget Nakasi is among the Ugandans who remember the attack.
There is a fear deep inside for crowded places, like, for example, to go for a football match where there are like thousands of people going to the stadium. I personally am not very comfortable with that.
Several bars and popular gathering places will screen the final matches live in and around Kampala, and police say they should follow set security measures. Among them is restricting entry and thorough body searches of those attending. Emilian Kaima is the Uganda police spokesperson.
We need owners of these venues to be well prepared. There are those who have been agitating to have open venues where people will come in from whichever side. That's very dangerous. We discourage that. We are encouraging closed venues where access control is well handled and well manned.
Kaima says police is adequately prepared for any eventualities. He says police have deployed counter-terrorism officers to inspect the venues that will screen the matches and ensure they meet the security standards.
And the criminals, especially terrorists, would want to remind us of their capacity to disrupt. Our readiness is total. We shall have strategic deployments with visibility being a guarantee. Both motorized and foot patrols will be in place to respond to any incidents, real or suspected. We shall require that continuous planning be in place to address serious incidents of crime and disorder that might erupt.
Joshua Kwebiha manages Club 400 in Bukoto, a Kampala suburb. He says they have hired private guards and police personnel to provide security.
One is to ensure that whoever enters the place must be checked thoroughly well. Secondly, to make sure that no one should enter this place when he's armed, but mostly to ensure that they have a stiff checkpoint. The bag should be checked thoroughly well and ensure that whenever someone, even when he goes out and comes back, it must be checked.
At Shadondo Rugby Club, one of the scenes of the 2010 attacks, security already has been heightened. Rita Kezala works at the club.
We cannot just forget that day in 2010, July, when we lost our loved ones during World Cup finals. Just like that, but I just miss of Uganda, has assured us that it's going to be there, and it has deployed so many officers to help us through that World Cup finals, and also us. We need to be alert as Ugandans. We just need to protect each other. We just need to be very careful.
The 2010 attacks were linked to Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, whose members said they struck Uganda for deploying its forces in Somalia. Ugandan forces, the UPDF, form the bulk of the African peacekeeping mission, AMISOM, that has been in Somalia since 2007. 8 people have been convicted and sentenced to prison in connection with the 2010 attack. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
International forensic scientists have arrived in the Gambia to help the government identify victims of human rights violations and abuses who died under the rule of former leader Yahya Jammeh. Gambia's Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadu says some bodies have been identified. Panderambai reports.
There are no official statistics on the number of political opponents who were allegedly killed by Jammeh's agents, but efforts are underway to exhume and test the bodies linked to his 22 years of brutal rule. So far, Gambian Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadu says 4 bodies have been identified.
I am also pleased to announce that over the past few weeks, I received a team of forensic scientists of Justice Rapid Response, an international NGO working in the area of international criminal justice.
He says the forensic scientists working with the Gambian Police Force Forensic Unit have examined human remains that were exhumed last year, and they have identified the remains of Solo Sanding. Sanding was a former official of the United Democratic Party, or UDP. He and other party supporters were arrested in April of 2016 after being accused of organizing a protest march without a police permit. He died in state custody after allegedly being tortured. Some of the women who were detained with Sanding said they were subjected to torture and degrading sexual abuse. Sanding's killers are standing trial for murder. Tambedu says preliminary results also have identified the remains of three others, Njaga Jan, Lami Sane, and Alaji Jaja Nyas. However, he says the results are still subject to confirmation. Sane, Jan, and Nyas were killed during an armed mutiny against Jammeh's government in December 2014. Some of the attackers came from the United States and died during the crossfire at the presidential palace at the State House in Banjul. Ismail Assise is a political science professor at the University of the Gambia.
I think it's a good move to bring the forensic scientists to come and help the Gambia government exhume those bodies. I think they've already been exhumed. We want to test, to ascertain that these are really who they are, to kind of identify those bodies. To also help the coroner's work to find out or to ensure or to investigate the cause of death.
CISA says the identification of the bodies will allow families to accord their loved ones a decent burial. But he says families are not only interested in paying their last respects to their loved ones, they also want justice. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have documented widespread human rights abuses under Jammeh's rule. Human Rights Watch is working with Jammeh's victims in Ghana to bring him to trial. Jammeh is accused of murdering over 50 Ghanaians who were mistaken as rebels in July of 2005. Professor Cisse believes that no matter how long it takes, Jammeh will face justice one day. Jammeh came to power in July of 1994 through a coup. He toppled the democratically elected government of President Sir Dauda Kairaba Jawara. He now lives in exile in Equatorial Guinea. For VOA Africa, this is Pandirimbay reporting.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News, coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, I bring you an exquisite listening experience. I have new music from artists like Le Berger and Kirani Ayat. Classic hits from Yondo Sister and Huma Sakela. Feature interviews and news with friends from Kenya.
Hello, everybody. Ni Juliane. And I'm in the Music Time in Africa with Heather Maxwell on The Voice of America.
All this and more on Music Time in Africa. Join me. Tune in this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 Universal Time. Catch you then.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.